Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Silman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me, because this is a show that really allows for in-depth conversation about topics that are really quite necessary these days. This is a place where we are able to have a conversation, we're able to explore, discuss important topics, and as I always like to say, it's about getting you informed with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And more than ever, that is such an important objective and goal and intention of this show. If you are joining me for the first time, I'd just like to welcome you. Hope you'll be coming back and joining my community on an ongoing basis. If you would like to get the archive shows from What Women Must Know, then you can go over to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know. Like me there, and you will be able to catch all of my shows. I actually have another show on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday at 11 a.m. called The Love Show, and that show is all about spiritual matters, inspiration, healing, transformation, and connecting us with the power found within our heart to transform all aspects of our life. So another great place to go to learn to heal and to become all that you can be. So I'm going to jump right into this hour's conversation. I'm so thrilled to welcome back an old friend who we probably haven't talked for a long, long time, although it just seems like the other day. And my guest today is Jeffrey Smith. And Jeffrey is someone I admire immensely. He is passionate. He is in true service to humanity, to nature, to the earth. And he has such vast wisdom and knowledge. And we're going to be talking about the existential threat you have never heard of. And we're talking about genetically engineered microbes. So if you're curious about what this is all about, then just stay tuned, because we're going to have a fascinating conversation. And I'd like to begin by just introducing Jeffrey Smith to everyone. As leading spokesperson on GMO health dangers, Jeffrey authored 2 global bestsellers, directed 5 films, delivered 1,000 lectures and 1,000 interviews in 45 countries, trained 1,500 speakers, and organized over 10,000 grassroots advocates. He is now sounding the alarm about the serious, even irreversible hazards from the new genetically engineering techniques which have led to health and environmental catastrophes. Jeffrey leads the Global Project Nature Now Coalition, urging governments to stop releasing of all genetic engineered microbes. And he has recently released a new short film called Don't Let the Gene Out of the Bottle, which conveys the threat posed by genetically engineered microbes to humans and the environment. This is a really important topic, and I am just so thrilled and honored to have Jeffrey Smith with us today. So, Jeffrey, hello, and welcome back again to What Women Must Know.
Thank you so much. It's great to connect once again.
Well, it is, and, you know, you are just truly an inspiration to me. I mean, all that you have accomplished, it's truly what one man can do, and I know you've had people supporting you in an organization, but you are just the passion that drives this this cause, this important message. And your message has had an huge impact all over the world. So I look forward to what this next phase of your work is all about and helping to get us as educated and enlightened about a really important topic. So let's talk about this. Let's talk about the concern for genetically engineered microbes. What is this all about, Jeffrey?
Well, what I'm going to share is pretty amazing. I'm going to talk about a microbe that was almost released that could have ended terrestrial plant life on the planet. Another one that was almost released that could have altered weather patterns permanently on the Earth. And these are the bad actors that, if released, could have cataclysmic outcomes. But what I want to also make sure that we cover is the importance of the microbiome for personal health, and how by genetically engineering it anywhere in the world, releasing a GMO microbe anywhere in the world, could influence our health in a dramatically negative way. And it's important to understand just how critical the microbiome is in our health and in ecosystem health, so that we understand that toying with it, introducing new genetic elements, could be a catastrophe.
So for those who are listening who may not understand the important role that these organisms, the microbes that live in our gut, the microbes that live in the soil, the microbes that live on our skin, why we have to be absolutely passionate about looking after these beings as we are about any other aspect of nature and our health.
Well, it's interesting. I was talking to microbiome expert Kiran Krishnan, and he believes, based on the data and over 50,000 studies conducted over the last 5 years, that 80% of all chronic diseases start with imbalance in the microbiome, all of the major common diseases. And this means that it functions like a second brain, it functions like another organ, and that not only that, but we have, in his estimation, outsourced approximately 90% of all of our everyday metabolic functions to the microbiome. He said there's no way that we can on our own without the microbiome know that, for example, we have a leaky gut in a certain place and that we need to fix this particular cell and change this mucosal layer of our gut, because that's handled. It is basically delegated to the microbiome. To put it in perspective, breast milk, a significant percentage of breast milk is indigestible by the infant, but it is not a mistake by nature, because it is designed not to be digested by the infant, to pass through the infant's stomach, to pass through the small intestines, to feed the microbiome of the infant. In fact, the infant becomes inoculated by the microbiome in the birth canal, because while the woman is pregnant, I believe it's in the second trimester, there is a migration of new bacteria into the birth canal that digests milk, because that is the bacteria that becomes inoculated into the newborn, and then there's more that becomes inoculated through the breast milk and even from the skin when the baby is breastfeeding. And when the baby is breastfeeding, the baby's microbiome, which assesses the needs of the baby and conveys it back to the mother through the skin on the nipple, so that the structure of the breast milk is changed in order to feed properly the microbiome of the baby, because the proper microbiome of the baby in the infant stage sets up health for decades. But not just that, because it's the mother's microbiome that can be passed on to future generations. Setting up a proper microbiome can even, for a baby, can influence the next generation. It is such a powerful tool of intelligence that when you take the microbiome of an overweight rodent and put it into an underweight rodent, the underweight rodent can gain weight and become obese. You can also transfer diseases by just taking the microbiome, doing fecal transplants from one organ, from one rodent to another, and from one human to another. An athlete received a fecal transplant and the particular disease or the gut problems that she was having got better, but then she started to gain weight because the person who was the donor of the fecal matter was overweight. And so you see, it's like a computer program of intelligence that is found in our microbiome that conducts our regular everyday metabolic activity and also dictates our health for the long term. And so I'm going to introduce in a few minutes how we can truly mess that up for ourselves and for everyone, and why we want to prevent that.
You know, when we really explore this universe that lives within us, populated by, you know, they say they don't even know thousands of different varieties of these organisms. It's astounding what they are actually able to do. It really is astounding. And, you know, I've had Kieran on my show several times. I always learn from him. And as someone who's focused on women's health, I was fascinated when he was explaining how the microbiome, a healthy microbiome, actually is necessary for and initiating the production of hormones like estrogen. So, you know, we think estrogen is made by the ovaries, but actually it's the microbiome that initiates that whole messaging that gets to produce the hormones. So every aspect from how we think in our moods to our immune system to our weight to, I mean, you name it, it's all part of the microbiome story. And as it was once told to me, when we take things like an antibiotic or whether it's an antibiotic or whether it's chemicals that have that effect, and I know we're going to talk a bit about the genetically engineered microbes, you are clear-cutting a rainforest. That's the analogy. And what happens is that when you clear-cut a rainforest, because it's indiscriminate, you have a regrowth or of things and species that shouldn't necessarily be there. And that's where Candida and other dysbiotic microbes take hold. So, and our health is compromised as a result, you know, and autoimmune diseases are, you know, an example of that. So we need to cultivate and honor and protect and really become vigilant about the world. And it's not just the microbiome in us, it's in animals, it's in the soil, and I know that's what we're going to touch into. And it's you know, honoring nature and being aware of what is being done to literally destroy the health of this web of life that we're all a part of.
I think a good place to start actually is in that film, Don't Let the Gene Out of the Bottle, which is at protectnaturenow.com, which kind of is designed to sound the alarm. And we chose some very powerful examples of worst case scenarios. So when in just readjusting the microbiome and making problems with our health, we might be dealing with chronic disease and having to spend years or decades recovering depending on our approach. But when we look at the foundation of what a changed microbiome can do to the planet, to our civilization, that's when we realize, in terms of a worst-case scenario, how urgent it is that we deal with it immediately. And we introduce a H5N1 avian flu virus. Now, we've all just been through a pandemic and still coming out, and we understand how every aspect of society was shaken up in a big way as a result of the pandemic. And the pandemic's death rate was, depending on who you talk to, less than 1%. It varied depending on the age group, et cetera. But the H5N1 virus death rate was 52%. 52% of the people who got the avian flu, this particular type of avian flu, died. But it was very, very hard to get this avian flu because you had to be hanging around birds a lot. And so only a few hundred people on the planet ever got this over many, many years. But genetic engineers wanted to understand the nature of this, and they, in their crazy wisdom, decided to make it airborne. As an airborne virus, it could theoretically be easy to contract, easy to spread. If it had escaped and created a pandemic, it could theoretically have decimated our population on the planet. So this is an example of a single microbe, a virus, that was genetically engineered to increase its infectability, its transmission ability, in a laboratory, and fortunately, it was not released. So that's an example of genetically engineering a potentially pandemic pathogen. But there's also microbes that can have similar devastating effects on the environment. And so we introduce another example, the name of this microbe, Klebsiella planticola. It's a particular bacterium that's found everywhere you look on the root structures of every plant in the world, in the soil. But genetic engineers had a, quote, good idea to genetically engineer the bacteria so that it would produce alcohol as it broke down plant matter. They are good idea, very well intentioned, was to distribute this bacteria to farmers. So instead of burning the crop residues on their field after harvest, they would rake them up and put them into huge barrels, put in the bacteria, and wait 2 weeks, and then open a spigot at the bottom, and out would come 34-proof alcohol, which they could then drive their tractors with, they could sell off-farm, and then they could take the nutrient-rich sludge on the bottom of the barrel and spread it on their fields as fertilizer. So the well-intentioned idea was to stop the crop burning, to give farmers more money, self-sufficiency in terms of fuel, and even turning crop residue into fertilizer instead of just releasing carbon in the space. So it had all these positive points. They submitted the bacteria to the EPA. It passed with flying colors. The EPA reviewed all the research that was required and done by these scientists. And these scientists were about to release this bacteria outdoors to see how far it would spread on its own. But a graduate student at Oregon State University wanted to get his PhD by doing research on a genetically engineered organism and got permission from these developers to work with this Klebsiella planticola. And so what he did was, very simple experiment, he took the nutrient-rich sludge at the bottom of the barrel and mixed it with soil and planted wheat seeds compared to controls that just used regular soil. But one day he came into his lab and all of the wheat plants had turned to slime. He discovered that the Klebsiella planticola was still active as part of this nutrient-rich sludge they had mixed with the soil, and it rendered the soil completely infertile because it was killing all of the plants by turning all of the roots and then the plants to alcohol. Now, he discovered this on a Saturday, and about 2 weeks later, they were planning to release this bacteria outdoors to see how far it would spread. The graduate student's advisor, Dr. Elaine Ingram, who I interview as part of this short film, she describes how whistleblowers at the EPA came to her and told her about a secret experiment that was conducted by the agency, where they too released bacteria to see how far it would spread, a different bacteria, fortunately. They released it in a field in Louisiana, and they found that over time, it spread everywhere on the planet. After several years, it was found everywhere, having been released in one place. Now, we know from the pandemic, we didn't need a pandemic to know that microbes can travel all around the world, but it was obvious now to everyone that microbes travel all over the world. In this case, it was confirmed by the Environmental Protection Agency. So here was this alcohol-producing bacteria that was supposed to be released to see how far it would spread. Imagine, and these are a bunch of ifs, but all plausible, if it had a survival advantage over the natural. Let's say the alcohol killed the normal Klebsiella planticola, but not the genetically engineered variety. And the Klebsiella planticola that was genetically engineered took over the niche and found itself on soil throughout the planet. And what does it do when it encounters cellulose, when it encounters plant material? It turns it to alcohol, and that kills plants. So in the film, you'll see Dr. Elaine Ingram answering my question, what's the logical outcome of releasing this bacteria in the world? And she said it would be an end to terrestrial plant life if it took hold and spread around the world. So we have these two examples, virus that could wipe out huge numbers of the human population, a bacteria that could theoretically, potentially, end terrestrial plant life on the planet, causing cataclysm. Another, we look at another microbe that could change weather patterns that they wanted to release in order to protect frost damage from crops like strawberries and potatoes, not knowing that the microbe actually becomes airborne and turns moisture into raindrops and snow, and they were going to disable that component. So if that became dominant and out-survived its natural competitor, it could have changed the way rain is formed. So these are examples of how bad actor microbes, if we genetically engineer them, could have a catastrophic or cataclysmic effect. And that's not talking about just the general microbiome. Those are particular bad actors that we wouldn't even know are bad actors, because in the case of the bacteria, both in case they were well-intentioned. Let's protect against frost damage. Let's turn crop residues into alcohol. But what happens when you release a microbe, Cheryl, is that it travels around the world and it mutates and it replicates. And I think most importantly, it engages in bacterial or microbial swap meets. So what happens is it will exchange its genetic elements with other microbes. And so the gene that you put in to create alcohol, to prevent frost damage, to whatever you had in mind, could end up in hundreds or thousands or millions of other types of species in different ecosystems on and off planet. And these changes, these new changes that you introduced in a lab, are not part of the billions of years of coevolution. Remember, we outsource 90% of our daily metabolic functions to the microbiome, but we did so over the eons in a beautiful, intelligent, orchestrated way. If a new genetic element gets into our ecosystem inside of us or into the ecosystem in our food supply, we have no idea of the impact of this new genetic element and what would happen if it takes hold. So we are playing more dangerous than playing with fire. We're playing with a element that becomes a permanent part of the gene pool that is life critical inside us and out.
Wow. As you're describing this, it's like we're living with these mad scientists and who really don't understand nature. And it's like, I've always believed that there, as a race, we have developed this huge intellect, and we're enamored by our brilliance. We're enamored right now by the technology and what we can do, which can be used for good. But if we don't have a true moral compass, we are just lost into the brilliant ideas and what we can create, which we can create anything, especially now because we have technology. But we're, it's like being out of control. It's this mad scientist that is not operating out of his heart. He's operating out of the ego and being just his own brilliance with having huge consequences. And the stories you're sharing are so terrifying to me, because we know that in nature, because there is this underground communication and probably airborne communication, plants throughout the entire world, all, not just plants, but they all the, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of microorganisms that live under the soil are necessary for the survival of life. This is like getting to the essence of life on this planet. And here we are experimenting and coming up with, interesting ideas, which have nothing to do with the reality.
I know. I should say, just to, because at this point, I think some of the listeners are very nervous. I want to say that we actually have a plan to protect nature now. That's the name of the coalition, Protect Nature Now. If you go to protectnaturenow.com, you could watch the film. But also, you can go to our advocacy platform and in a single click, send important educational information about this to all of your elected officials, local, state, and federal. And you can send them tweets with a single click and post on their Facebook, etc. And we're sending them repeated information over and over again. We've reached thousands of elected officials through this process, and we're building up a movement that will end up creating laws to protect against the release of genetically engineered microbes in the environment, and even against the gain-of-function enhancement of potentially pathogenic microbes in laboratories, things like the H5N1. So we're actually building a global movement with a new global coalition. We could appreciate everyone's participation, financial support, ways of getting information out to your social media, etc. We're setting it up now, but we have had experience doing this. I worked for 25 years building a global non-GMO movement regarding food. Now we're doing it at a much more accelerated pace to lock down GM microbes around the world. And one thing that we have on our side now is this awe-inspiring research about the role of the microbiome. I remember interviewing Dietrich Klinghardt and others about the microbiome in terms of health, and he pointed out that the recent studies on St. John's wort show that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But if you look at how the preparation of the St. John's wort was done, it's possible that those that didn't work were the preparation destroyed the microbiome on the herb, and that there are people who believe that the herbs work not because of the plant matter in the herbs, but because of the microbiome on the herbs. And that he said that salad, for example, is nutritious, but we only actually absorb 5% of it. He said maybe it's the microbiome on the greens that we're eating that is far more nutritious than the actual pieces of lettuce. He and others talked about how if a woman has a tumor in her breast, the new type of bacteria will migrate into the breast to protect the woman. When they didn't know that and they killed the bacteria there, the tumor expanded and it metastasized, that the bacteria actually was protective. Zach Bush told me that there's a type of fungus that goes into the brain to protect when there's when someone has Alzheimer's, and that people are misinterpreting it as causing Alzheimer's, but it's actually the microbiome, the micro Jedi army that is working inside of us. And so we have this connection to this unseen world that is so much more intelligent. We could never create the intelligence ourselves with our minimal understanding by constructing a microbe from scratch or adjusting it. And yet, as you said, there are scientists who simply do not understand what's going on with nature. In fact, no one really understands the true magnificence of the microbiome. We've only even been able to identify 30% of the microbes in soil and haven't been able to really understand the intricacies. And yet we are willing to risk the balance of those ecosystems because we think in very reductionist ways. We put the blinders on and think if we release it, it's just going to be on the farm creating alcohol. It's just going to be on the strawberry plant. It's just going to be in this body, but not end up in an infant on the other side of the world or in the atmosphere or in the deep sea. And this is where we have cut ourselves off from the nature of nature, but we've done it now with tools that could destroy it permanently. So we have to convey to the world, not just through new laws in every country, which is part of our goal, but to stabilize those laws so that they don't get overturned with regime change and special interests. Stabilize it by getting it into curriculums and popular culture and books and films so that everyone realizes we have arrived at an inevitable time in human civilization where we can redirect the streams of evolution for all time very easily, very cheaply, and with this new technology comes a new responsibility. Because otherwise we will end biological evolution as we know it. And in order to protect biological evolution as we know it, we must have a new relationship with nature. We must steward nature, protect nature now and in the future. So the calling of this time for our very survival is an up-leveling of our awareness from that narrow, blinded thinking and the reductionist thinking to an understanding of our role and nature's role and the intelligence of nature, which is so magnificently expressed in the microbiome.
Well, that's so well put, Jeffrey. I have to say you're really eloquent. And, just to add, I've spent time in the Amazon. I've spent time with plant medicines there and in Costa Rica. And I can tell you the gift that I received from being with these plants. And they have really opened me to appreciate the vast intelligence that the kingdom of nature is. We just, for most in our culture, in the Western culture, as opposed to more indigenous cultures, which have a closer relationship and appreciation and honoring of nature, we have been trained to perceive nature as, something to be harvested by us and used by us. But with those experiences of being in the Amazon and being with the intelligence of plants, it has been a profound transformation for me in the way that I have such a deep honoring and respect of nature and this deep, deep intelligence that exists within and throughout all of nature. And, what we're sharing, the initial part of our conversation is terrifying. It is terrifying to think that we've arrived at a place that we have a science that without the right guidelines can be totally destructive to all of humanity and the planet. But you are on the forefront of creating positive change, and we are at a time, I believe, that we have this opportunity and possibility for this enlightenment, for this awakening, for this renewal of our responsibility to nature. And I'm so happy that you're doing the work you're doing because it does give us hope and it gives us a direction and a focus where we can be part of this movement that you are initiating.
I lost you. Did you press mute accidentally?
I don't think so. I'm still here.
Okay, I got you now. Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much, Cheryl. It's interesting. One of my sayings is, think huge. Thinking big is so last century. And we have huge issues right now. And to some it feels like, we go through an education process that gives away our power to the teachers, it gives away our power to others and to our employers, et cetera, to the medical establishment, et cetera. So people are kind of trained in this Western civilization, not in the indigenous way, but in the Western civilization, to feel like someone else is going to take care of us and that they need to do it and they need to initiate it. But here, one of the issues is that we now have to take back. We who have the understanding have to apply that understanding and not just let others do it and hope that others get to it. It's part of that relationship with nature means that we have a role to play. And when we were talking about indigenous, it reminded me of a story. A friend of mine was talking to an indigenous elder in Hawaii in the early 90s who described that somehow around this time or a little bit earlier, we were going to be facing the threat of an end of biological evolution as we know it. That was the phrase that the elder gave to my friend John. And when he said those words, an end of biological evolution as we know it, I realized I could not think of a better expression to characterize the threat from these new GMOs that are so easy to create and change the nature of nature. And so this indigenous wise elder 30 years ago was aware of these new techniques, these new genetic technologies, at least the threat of them, and was calling upon my friend John and others to step up and, in his words, to catch the earth as it fell and stand it up in a good way. And so I feel like that is the opportunity and the honor of this generation. I don't take this work as a burden. I take it as an honor because we get to protect the biological evolution as we know it, all living beings, all future generations. Their fate is tied up in the work that we do now. And so it's an honor to be serving at that level, and that's my invitation. So that when you talk about my work, I'm really hoping that the people listening don't just relegate it or delegate it to me, but and to our coalition, but rather to think how they can step up. And so we have the advocacy platform. We have ways that people can be click and send revolutionary heroes, how they can, we'll be having speaker training programs and advocacy training programs, and we'll have opportunities for people to raise local laws at their city council, at their county council. All these things are coming as we get more funding, and that's another way that people can participate, and that is to make a regular monthly contribution that happens automatically so we can count on it and build the staff that we need to implement these programs around the world. Because right now it's an urgent situation. Because as we speak, the lobbyists from the biotech industry are trying to convince the Canadian government there should be no regulations of gene-edited GMOs. Same fight is going on in the UK. We lost it already in Japan. They're trying to pressure the EU to renege on regulating gene-edited GMOs. The U.S., we have basically abdicated our responsibility for these regulating these new GMOs. And so it is a fiercely pitched battle right now to determine whether we are going to be handing the keys to all the kingdoms to whoever has a gene editing kit in their garage, or whether we're going to protect nature right now.
So first of all, we need to give the website, which is protectnaturenowcoalition.org.
Well, let me give you two of them. Actually, protectnaturenow.com gets you to the film, Don't Let the Gene Out of the Bottle. I think that's a good first step. It's only 16 minutes. It's fast-paced. And I think when you finish the film, you're going to want to do something. At that point, you can go to the coalition page, which is, you can get a link from the first page. So you only have to remember one, protectnaturenow.com. And that coalition, that advocacy page will give you an opportunity to send a pre-written note or customize it yourself to elected officials. You can also, on that slide, make a donation. You can go to the Library of Assets and take a look at some of the resources. I do interviews with lots of different scientists. There's reports. We have a legislative report. We're going to release a white paper shortly. We have two or three other white papers that are in preparation. So when you become part of this movement, education is key. It's critical. So protectnaturenow.com is the landing page that I want to recommend everyone go to.
Well, I think that's a great place to begin, and I'll put it in the show notes as well, protectnaturenow.com. You know, it seems like a David and Goliath issue, Jeffrey, and you've been in this battle a really long time. What else is happening that's inspirational for us out here? So we know that we can make a difference. We know that we can change this trend that's going on with all these biotech companies. What else can you share with us that is going to inspire us and help us move forward?
Well, it's a great question. There's a lot of very good news. 25 years ago when I started in the GMO world, no one was talking about the health dangers of GMOs. None of the nonprofits, they didn't want to touch it. We started to pioneer messaging about the health dangers, and many people then started picking it up, you know, and now 51% of the U.S. population, 48% of the world population, believe that GMO foods are likely dangerous for health. That is driving consumer dollars to the non-GMO food, which is driving industry to replace their GM ingredients with non-GMOs. So we're actually in a tipping point around the world based on consumer knowledge. Knowledge has organizing power. In addition, we all know, or many of us know, that one of the main reasons they genetically engineer crops is to spray those crops with Roundup herbicide. Monsanto creates the Roundup. They create the crops, and so they sell them as a package. Well, Roundup has come into the news in the last 6 years as a probable human carcinogen. And I was following very closely the trials that we won. Three trials were won where the jury said that Monsanto's Roundup caused the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma of four plaintiffs. And they also became aware of the devious, backhanded methods used by Monsanto to try to hide the evidence. And so not only were they giving compensatory damages in the millions, their combined punitive damages were in the billions, because they wanted to punish Monsanto for hiding evidence, rigging research, threatening scientists, ghostwriting their own material and paying scientists to put their name on it. All that came out, and that went around the world. So that has been tremendous news. I mean, obviously, the fact that people got cancer from Roundup is not tremendous news. The fact that it was discovered and broadcast around the world is absolutely essential, because now we know we don't use Roundup on our gardens, but also we need to eat organic, because Roundup is sprayed on the grains and beans and in many other foods in our food supply. It's sprayed on the grains to just before harvest to speed up the ripening, to kill the weeds for the next season. And what happens is it ends up in the oats. It ends up in the wheat. It ends up in the lentils, in the chickpeas, in the mung beans. It's sprayed to clear the aisles between the vineyards. And so it ends up in our wine. It's sprayed on orchards, so it ends up in our orange juice, in our beer. So it's really important to eat organic to protect ourselves. And now people are realizing it's not just a carcinogen, but it also is an endocrine disruptor. It can mess up our neurotransmitters like serotonin, melatonin, and dopamine. It's an antibiotic that can damage the gut microbiome. It can grab minerals, making them unavailable. It can damage the DNA. It can hurt the mitochondria. All these things from this one highly dangerous chemical that's in the food supply. So now we're in a second wave of understanding, not just that GMOs are dangerous, but that non-organic foods can carry this and these and other chemicals, and we need to avoid that. And so that movement is growing. So education is critical. It is changing behavior. It is changing the nature of these corporations who have to respond to consumer demand. But now, with the microbiome, the laws we need to put in, consumer demand at the grocery store isn't going to stop the release of GMO microbes. So we need to actually do the contacting the members of Congress and the local state legislatures, et cetera. But fortunately, we make that easy, and it's done in a few moments.
I have a question. I'm just wondering, has there been a reduction in the use of Roundup in agriculture with all of these serious lawsuits and damages?
I actually haven't looked at the total numbers, but there definitely is regionally. They've declared it illegal soon in Mexico. They're going to stop using it there, in Germany, in a number of other places. Certain major garden centers, box stores are no longer selling it. So there has been a reduction around the world since the International Agency for Research on Cancer, WHO, committee declared it a Class 2A carcinogen in March of 2015. And that's when Monsanto started their huge disinformation program, trying to discredit the World Health Organization, ghostwriting commentary pieces. All that came out in the trials. It was absolutely devious what they were doing. And we also learned that they had their own lapdogs in the Environmental Protection Agency, people that were working on their behalf, stopping research on glyphosate, which is the chief poison in Roundup, and cancer from other organizations, saying that it had no effect on cancer because they decided to cherry-pick just Monsanto's research and ignore the peer-reviewed independent research. So that we saw how they captured regulatory agencies, and that information is getting out, which is driving more and more governments, et cetera, and also companies to stop using it.
Well, it certainly has been a victory and probably a very long time coming. I know that some of those legal cases have gone on for a long time before it actually came to a decision. So, and some were lost, right? And some never made it to the court. Some were squashed beforehand. But persistence pays off. And the science is growing on the dangers, as you described, so many of the effects that we know, the destruction of the microbiome. So, you know, there's. I want to go back to the positive message, Jeffrey. So if you want, can we talk more about what you are offering? I really want to inspire everyone listening to take action and to know that they can do something that will make a difference and to really get into action. So tell us more about your projects, the Protect Nature Now, what you're going to be offering when they go to the website and film, and you know, really being able to move forward and doing something that's going to help make this huge difference to our planet.
Absolutely. So we actually already have members of Congress in D.C. who are ready to champion our cause. But we are not ready to ask them to activate yet because we need to build the numbers of people that actually go to our site, to our advocacy platform, and send the information out. We have reached over 2,000 elected officials, and we want to do it multiple times with many, many campaigns where people can just spend 2 or 3 minutes on the advocacy platform clicking and sending, or some more time if they want to customize the message. We need to get a very large number of people in that position, but not just in the United States. We actually have 50 global allies already, and we just started this year reaching out to the world. We expect that to be hundreds very soon. I was just on the phone with some organizations related to regenerative agriculture. Regenerative agriculture holds the promise of drawing down the excess carbon into the soil, and the microbes, the microbiome of the soil, do the heavy lifting, and they need to make sure that the microbiome is protected against genetic engineering. So many of them are on board, which also means that many of the people in the climate change community is on board. The oceans, protecting the oceans, algae from research produces 50 to 80% of the oxygen for the planet. And if that metabolic pathway gets messed up through genetic engineering, that could suffocate the planet. So there's interest from the oceans people. There's interest in animal rights, interest in gardeners and birders, and of course the health people. So what's really works to our advantage was within the first 5 minutes of our conversation, Cheryl, people got it. It was like, whoa, this is intense. If you watch the film, you get it within 5 minutes. It's a 16-minute film, but you get it in 5 minutes, and that's to our advantage. It's not a complicated technological scientific issue. Microbes travel around the world. They swap genetic material. New genetic elements can disrupt and damage ecosystems, even collapse ecosystems. We need to protect nature now. Very simple. I used to travel a lot speaking about GMOs, and I gave 8 talks before the pandemic basically stopped my traveling, where I introduced the question to the audience at the beginning, and I said, what do you think is a greater danger, GMOs or climate change? And I would have a show of hands, and I was shocked every time that every audience rated GMOs as a greater danger. I wasn't expecting that. That also works to our advantage. People have a understanding that when you manipulate the genome, it can carry risks that are hard to quantify but are very real. So when it's so, when people are predisposed to knowing that, when it's easy to convey, when it's easy to activate, we have the makings of a very powerful global movement. And because of the pandemic, we have more receptivity than at any time ever, because people realize that microbes travel around the world. They have the example of the pandemic. They can look at the H5N1, that it has at least 24 times more lethality than the COVID-19. They can see the dangers like never before. There's a political will to meet the unmet need to protect against future pandemics. If there is a silver lining to this pandemic, this is one of them, that we may actually protect the globe and the population and nature now, because the pandemic has put people in the most receptive mood to protect, to locking down genetically engineered microbes. And whether or not the Wuhan Institute of Virology is determined to be the source of the COVID-19 virus or not, that's not important. But the fact that people are realizing it could be, now they realize that genetic engineering in laboratories could release future pandemics. We need to lock that down. So this is a perfect time, Cheryl, a perfect time to start this global movement. And it's a perfect time in the science, that we have so much science there, so we can demonstrate to elected officials and to the rest of the world why it's so important to protect these little guys.
Well, not only is it perfect time, but it is, the 11th hour. If we don't, as you say, put the genie back into the bottle, who knows? You only want to think about it. So it just can't happen. It can't happen. So this is why I just so respect the work you're doing, and the fact that you have a plan, and that you are able to strategize and know what needs to be done. And it's like calling the troops mm-hmm. into action. So let's give that information again. And the fact that you have put this short 16-minute documentary together is a great way to share it in social media. I'm going to be sharing it on my social media platforms. And we can just start that awakening process, right? Just get people to, first of all, understand what the problem is and know that you're offering a strategy to move us into action. So we need to remind everyone, please go to protectnaturenow.com. And that's where you're going to find the film and other information, and it'll lead you to other websites. I will just mention that another website is protectnaturenowcoalition.org, and you'll be guided to how you can get into action, how you can contribute, how you can truly make a difference. It just feels different. This is the time of this global awakening, of restoring our right relationship with nature. And what I really appreciate about your work, it empowers us. We don't feel like we're in a helpless situation against these huge biotech companies, that we really have the ability and we have the guidance and the power and the education to truly change the direction and transform our world. And I, again, am so grateful to you and for the passion and commitment for, gosh, decades now of taking on this cause. You know, in a sense, not that you're doing this on your own, but initially it was very much single-handedly with this passion. You were the spearhead. So we just have a couple of minutes. Do you want to have a concluding comment to make about you, your work, your passion, your vision?
Well, thank you, yes. First of all, I want everyone to know we are a 501c3 nonprofit tax-exempt organization, and we all run in our institute on the support of donors, and that I am not naive in terms of how much resources it's going to take to implement this around the world. We're going to have to raise far more money than we've ever raised in my entire 25 years put together, and we need to do it quickly. So if people are interested in making a donation, ideally a recurring donation, so we can know what's coming each month and hire staff, one of the early things we did with our campaign is to create an ideal staff organization chart as to who we needed to hire, what firms we needed to hire, and how much it would cost. And it was in the millions of dollars per year. And I don't want that to dissuade people from contributing $5 each month, because we may need to build our millions on the basis of $5 by millions of people. So first of all, I want to make sure that people know that the need is real and that the money is being spent very, very carefully to this end, to protect nature. Second, I am aware that we can make a change. I've seen, as you said in the beginning when you introduced me, I've been to 45 countries, and I've seen somehow that visiting a country in 2 weeks can make a huge difference in the policies going forward. They can change federal policies. They can change industrial policies. They can change an awareness very, very quickly. And so I've been part of a movement building exercise for 2.5 decades, and in training people and organizing, and this is very doable. This is very doable, and the urgency actually helps it. Your point about being the 11th hour helps it. We all know that when there's a, this is your last chance offer. If you don't act now, you won't get it. This is the last chance offer to protect nature now. It's not like we want to wait, I'll wait a year or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. We don't have that luxury. We have an opportunity and a need right now. And so I'm encouraging, the last thing I'll say is this, in someone that's been focusing on behavior change messaging regarding food, et cetera, I'm aware that when people get inspired, what's absolutely critical is they make a decision to do something and a commitment right away. So if people listening are committed, wanting to go to watch the film or go to the advocacy platform or going to make a donation or sharing the film with someone or sharing this podcast with other people, please do so soon. Because if you wait an hour or 5 hours or a day, or the chances of you actually doing it drop considerably, and we don't have that luxury. So please make some kind of commitment to action, do some sort of action right away in the direction of implementing this way of protecting nature. And you'll be joining a team. And that team, our team, is involved in protecting all living beings and all future generations. And as one who supports them, we believe in that mystical reciprocity that you talked about from the Amazon, we can get support from all living beings and all future generations working together.
Beautiful words, and I definitely am inspired and will be contributing and donating to your cause. I feel it very deeply. So, Jeffrey, thank you again for the, just the immense work you're doing, the passion and your service to the earth. So it's just been an honor to connect with you again, to have you on the show, and thank you for the wonderful education and the inspiration that you always bring. And just wishing you all the best. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you so much.
And you're so welcome. And thank you all for listening. It's just always a pleasure and an honor to be with you and to share my guests with you. So it's time to go. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.